Trump suggests injecting Clorox, Pence orders no mask with mayo, and Amash talks about a third helping. How's that to whet your appetite on The Political Junkie? I'm Ken Rudin. Trump's not happy with shutdowns. Georgia Governor Kemp ends shutdowns. Trump not happy with Kemp. Please explain.
The governor got separate phone calls from both President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence that same night, applauding his move. So a day later, the president quickly changed his tone.
Plus, is Susan Collins' winning streak about to come to an end in Maine?
This upstart, this Speaker of the House, who has relatively little experience beyond legislative experience at the State House, is doing as well as she is among the electorate. That's a phenomenon in terms of Maine politics.
And we go back a half century to the killings of four students at Kent State University.
It was a moment when our country changed, and it was a moment in which our thinking about the Vietnam War changed.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 326 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The suggestion by President Trump that maybe a cure for the virus would be to inject a disinfectant was bad enough.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning, because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that, so that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
That was followed by a typical response by the president when he realizes he stepped in it.
Now, I was asking a question sarcastically to reporters like you just to see what would happen.
What was most disheartening was to hear Dr. Deborah Birx, a leader of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, say this about the media. Here she was on CNN when Jake Tapper told her that poison control centers have been issuing warnings about the danger of injecting Lysol.
As a doctor, doesn't that bother you that you have to even spend any time discussing this?
It bothers me that this is still in the news cycle, because I think we're missing the bigger pieces of what we need to be doing as an American people to continue to protect one another. And we should be having that dialogue about asymptomatics. We should be having that dialogue about this unique clotting that we're seeing.
And she doubled down on the media on Fox News.
I think the media is very slicey and dicey about how they put sentences together in order to create headlines. I think, you know, we know from millennials and other studies that some people may only read the headlines, and if there's not a graphic, they're not going to look any further than that. And I think we have to be responsible about our headlines. I think often the reporting may be accurate in paragraph 3, 4, and 5, but I'm not sure how many people actually get to paragraph 3, 4, and 5. And I think the responsibility that the press has is to really ensure that the headlines reflect the science and data that is in their piece itself.
A2, Deborah? Moving on to the presidential race, it seems like Joe Biden's problems with Bernie Sanders supporters are not over. The decision this week by Democratic members of the New York State Board of Elections to cancel the June 23rd primary because of the coronavirus pandemic has led to widespread anger from the Sanders camp. The party said it wouldn't be fair to have poll workers risk their health to work, and since Bernie was out of the race, what would be the problem? As one of the party people said, what the Sanders supporters want is essentially a beauty contest that, given the situation with the public health emergency that exists now, seems to be unnecessary and, indeed, frivolous. Nonsense, said the Sanders people. There are still delegates to be elected and a platform to be voted on, they say. Plus, since there will still be congressional and other contests that day, what would it matter if the presidential race remained on the ballot? Given the still tense negotiations going on between the Biden and Sanders camps, canceling the primary seems to have been an ill-advised decision that could only exacerbate the two sides' differences. Doesn't make sense to me. If the June 23rd primary ballot has gotten a little less crowded, the opposite may be the case for the November ballot. Justin Amash, a congressman from Michigan who quit the GOP last year and became an independent, announced Tuesday that he's forming an exploratory committee to seek the Libertarian Party's presidential nomination.
I don't want to run to be a spoiler, never wanted to run to be a spoiler, wanted to run to win the presidency. And I feel like there is a good chance of doing that with this field and with the kind of tension in this country, you know, over these candidates. There's a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who don't like these candidates and want something different.
Of course, that's what Gary Johnson, the Libertarian nominee in 2016, said, that the negatives for Trump and Hillary Clinton were so great that it gave candidates like him a shot at victory. Obviously, that didn't happen, though the nearly 4.5 million votes Johnson received, about 3.3% of the total, was the best showing for a Libertarian in presidential history. The situation with Amash leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last sitting member of the House who gave up his or her seat to run for president as a third-party candidate? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Political divisions in this country have gotten to the point where the decision to wear a mask or not depends on whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. While there are, of course, exceptions, Democrats seem to be willing to accept governors who tell their citizens to stay at home. Republicans seem more anxious to resume business as usual. When President Trump sent out tweets that called for the liberation of Minnesota and Wisconsin and Virginia, many of his supporters found themselves outside the respective state capitals protesting the Democratic governors, note that the states Trump singled out has Democratic governors, and urging them to end the quarantine. Georgia took it one step further. Last week, Brian Kemp, the Republican governor who probably owes his election in 2018 to a key Trump endorsement, called for an early reopening of businesses, such as gyms, nail salons, bowling alleys, and tattoo parlors. Restaurants also resumed dine-in service. In addition, the state's beaches and parks are open because he never closed them. Given the lack of adequate testing in the state, many businesses remain cautious, holding off from rushing to reopen. Even Trump wondered if Kemp had gone too far.
I told the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, that I disagree strongly with his decision to open certain facilities which are in violation of the phase one guidelines for the incredible people of Georgia. They're incredible people. I love those people. They're great. They've been strong, resolute. But at the same time, he must do what he thinks is right. I want him to do what he thinks is right. But I disagree with him on what he's doing.
Is this a case of politics overruling common sense, or is it a part of Republican belief in free enterprise and individual rights? And what happens if infection rates go up? What are they saying in the Peach State? Greg Bluestein is a political reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled you're here, and I'm glad to hear that you're safe and well and healthy, and that's all that matters. And, you know, Greg, there is obviously so much to talk about, especially with Georgia, because you guys, you have two Senate races at stake. You have a possible vice presidential candidate. You have growing Democratic optimism in a state that Trump won by barely reaching 50% of the vote 4 years ago. And that's in addition to dealing with the virus.
Yeah, it's a very good time to be a political reporter in Georgia, It also means we're overwhelmed. We would already be busy gearing up for the June 9th primary, but we've got to cover the state's coronavirus response on top of all that. So it's an embarrassment of riches right now. No complaining, but a lot of things to cover.
Well, let's start with Governor Kemp's decision to reopen the state. How was that received?
Mixed. You know, there was a University of Georgia poll that showed a majority of voters were against his decision to begin lifting some of these economic restrictions. In Metro Atlanta, it was widely panned by not only the mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, but also local Republican and Democratic officials and public health experts who worried it could trigger a new outbreak. But if you get further outside of the Metro Atlanta area, the densely populated areas, you saw more willingness, especially in conservative rural counties, to reopen businesses. I went to several of them. I went to North Georgia and to Central Georgia to talk to business owners, and they were gearing up for a big reopening. Restaurant owners resumed in-person dining. Ice cream shop owners and pizzeria owners get ready to fling their doors open. And of course, they were taking additional precautions as laid out by the governor. But these are precautions that are really hard for law enforcement to track. But there was a sense of optimism as you got further outside of Metro Atlanta that these restrictions needed to be lifted.
But everything I've been reading says that Georgia's testing system for the virus is supposed to be well behind that of most other states.
Yeah, depending on the day, Georgia was either in the high 30s or low 40s in per capita testing as ranked around the nation. So the state is still very far behind. They're ramping up. In recent days, we've had record numbers of testing, still far behind bigger states and some smaller states that are doing a better job in per capita testing. The governor, though, insists that those measures, as well as a new contact tracing program that's designed to follow people around people who have been diagnosed with this virus, will pay dividends and will show that Georgia has met these guidelines. But even the public health commissioner here, Dr. Kathleen Toomey, conceded that Georgia has not met all the criteria under the White House's gating requirements to reopen businesses.
Do we know why Kemp was so out in front of other governors on this?
Yeah, it's important to remember a little of the history here, too, because he was also behind many of the other governors in instituting these restrictions in the first place. Many other states, even Republican-led states, had already imposed statewide orders, whereas in Georgia, for a long time, through late March, only local officials were doing their own restrictions, whereas there was no statewide order. So you had some counties with curfews and other counties with minimal restrictions. It was a hodgepodge. And so the governor stepped in early April and instituted a statewide mandate. But again, he was among the last wave of governors to do so. He was also seemed eager throughout to at least consider lifting them. He talked a lot about how hard it was hearing from supporters and Georgians whose, you know, lifelong savings and their businesses that they spent years, decades building went up in smoke. So he really struggled, very vocally struggled with that decision. I mean, I interviewed him and we went to every single one of his press conferences, and each one he talked about how hard that decision was. And so when he seemed to be getting signals from the White House that they were eager to start reopening, he was one of the first to aggressively jump on board and announce that many of these businesses he had closed, not all, but many of these businesses he closed, we're talking barbershops, nail salons, bowling alleys, gyms, and dining rooms at restaurants, could start reopening, so at least this week. And it seemed like he had the White House's backing, at first at least.
That's the part I'm most confused about, because Trump criticized Kemp in pretty strong terms, and yet the day before that, he sounded supportive. You know, he called for the liberation of states under stay-at-home orders and encouraged protesters in states with Democratic governors, and then he criticized Kemp. I'm confused about what seemed to be mixed signals.
I'm sure it's easy to say the governor was confused, too. I mean, we were kind of stunned down here in Georgia because, by all accounts, when the governor announced that plan about a week ago, that same day, the president said, he had confidence in the nation's governors without singling out Kemp. And then, as we understand it, what the AJC reported was that the governor got separate phone calls from both President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence that same night applauding his move. So a day later, the president quickly changed his tone. CNN reported that it was because of pressure from his White House coronavirus task force, saying essentially with those influential doctors saying they couldn't stand with Trump's decision if he were to applaud Georgia's move. So that night was a night to remember in Georgia, because that was when the president broke with Governor Kemp. And these, again, as you mentioned, tremendous allies. Trump's late endorsement 6 days before the Republican runoff in 2018 fueled Kemp's runaway victory over a better-known Republican rival, and his support down the stretch, including a visit just 3 days before the November election against Stacey Abrams, you know, helped drive out turnout in a race that was decided by very, very small numbers. It was the closest race for Georgia governor since the 1960s.
Bo Calloway and Lester Maddox. How about that?
Yeah, 1960s. You got it. Nice. Good memory.
I'm sorry. It was yesterday. I know there was some bitterness on Trump's part when Kemp decided to name his own choice for a Senate vacancy and not pick Trump's choice. You don't think that plays into anything? That's still not going on between them, is it?
I've seen some national reporting saying that that's the reason why the president has lashed out. It's hard for me to believe that that is the reason why he made this decision. If only, I mean, certainly he's irritated by it. But also, you know, Senator Loeffler, who the governor ended up appointing over Doug Collins, who was the president's pick, has, you know, gone to great lengths to try to curry favor with the president. And he said nice things about her over the last few months, too. So it's not like, you know, she hasn't been a Trump loyalist since taking office in January.
Well, speaking of Loeffler, she's gotten herself some unwanted publicity with accusations of insider trading. How is that affecting her race against Doug Collins?
This is the time where we wish we had done more polling of these races. We've done polling of the other race. There's two Georgia Senate races. David Perdue is also up for election, but we haven't seen any public polling. Certainly the internal pollings we've seen have shown Kelly Loeffler's standing take a hit. And the other important thing happening down here is you're starting to see public officials who are on the sidelines. They're taking sides, and they're tending to go with Doug Collins, the four-term congressman from Gainesville, Georgia, who is running against Kelly Loeffler.
And finally, I have to end with this, but I don't know what to make of this either. Stacey Abrams. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I have never, ever seen a candidate so openly campaign for the vice presidency. It's stunning to me. I mean, whether she's qualified or not, I know people want the vice presidency. I remember John Edwards saying he doesn't want it, you know, in 2004, but he did want it. But I've never seen anybody campaign so openly for the pick to be vice president.
You're right. She's totally flipping the script. And yes, yeah, tradition that people who do want the job say they don't. Look at Dick Cheney. Look at Joe Biden. Look at John Edwards. Whoever it might be, they always say, oh, you know, I'm not in this for second place. I'm perfectly fine doing whatever the job it is I have now. I've talked to Stacey about that, as she's talked with many other members of the media about that. And she feels it's an obligation, a duty for someone as an African-American woman, if they're asked about taking such an important job, to go out there and say that they're going to do it, you know, that they want it, rather than trying to be coy about it. So she sees this as sort of an example set, a level set, that other African-American women should follow. It obviously remains to be seen whether she'll get the gig. But right now, it's seeming like insiders are more sour on her chances because of the pandemic in a way, because, you know, Democratic Party leaders want to see someone with more experience. Certainly she can excite the electorate, but we in Georgia have no doubt that if she doesn't get it, she will run for a rematch against Governor Brian Kemp. And she's been one of his more vocal critics about his response to the pandemic, panning it fairly often, saying that she even agrees with President Trump when he just disregarded the governor's approach to reopening businesses.
Not to jump on Stacey Abrams like others have been doing it, but given the fact that Joe Biden will be 78 years old, you know, shortly after the election, and she has, what, 6-7 years as a member of the Georgia State Legislature, that's kind of tough to put somebody like that as a second, you know, a heartbeat away from the presidency.
Yeah, it's made her challenge all the more daunting. At the same time, too, with foreign relations experience, you don't get too much of that working in the Georgia House.
I know we have a virus to be concerned about, and obviously that is our most important concern. But if I can just look only at politics for a second, this is going to be a very busy 6 months in Georgia politics.
Tremendously busy. And you're right, we still have the pandemic. I've been personally torn between covering whatever the governor's doing with this pandemic and also covering the political angles all around, not just him and his decisions, but also all these other great races we have in Georgia. And I wrote just last week that the governor's decision to reopen the businesses will define his political career, certainly. You know, we won't really know for a few more weeks or maybe even months whether or not it was a good decision to let barbershops and bowling alleys and nail salons reopen.
And tattoo parlors.
And tattoo parlors and all these other what we call close contact businesses that he closed a month ago. But certainly his opponents and his allies won't forget that decision soon. And already we're seeing some Republicans distance themselves from the governor. I talked to about a dozen over the last few days to try to get their reactions on the record, and very, very few of them would speak publicly. So that shows you just how touchy the situation is right now for the governor.
And he's not up for re-election until 2022.
Not until 2022, where when he knows that Stacey Abrams and her, basically the juggernaut she built, that she really started building back in 2016, will be back if she's not a vice presidential contender or in the White House in some form or fashion.
Greg Bluestein is a political reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg, thank you for being on the show, and please stay safe.
You too, and thanks as always for having me. I always love coming on.
Susan Collins, the Republican senator from Maine, who sometimes breaks from her party's positions, surprised some by voting against impeaching President Trump earlier this year. But fear not, she said to Nora O'Donnell of the CBS Evening News, Trump had learned a lesson.
I believe that the president has learned from this case.
What do you believe the president has learned?
The president has been impeached. That's a pretty big lesson. I'm voting to acquit because I do not believe that the behavior alleged reaches the high bar in the Constitution for overturning an election and removing a duly elected president.
But the president says he did nothing wrong. Why do you think he learned something?
He was impeached, and there has been criticism by both Republican and Democratic senators of his call. I believe that he will be much more cautious in the future.
Fast forward to the present, and it's fair to say that few people think Trump had learned a lesson. He has already proven that he has no desire to be much more cautious in the aftermath of his impeachment. And that has placed Collins in a difficult position this year as she seeks a fifth term. Her reputation as a maverick has served her well in Maine, where she has won 3 landslide re-elections, the last 2 with over 60% of the vote. In all 3 re-election races, she carried every county in the state. But she's in for a tough race this year. Her Democratic opponent is expected to be Sarah Gideon, the Speaker of Maine's House. Gideon has raised more than $7 million in the first quarter of the year, compared to $2.4 million for Collins. Gideon has now raised nearly $15 million since launching her campaign, not including some $4 million that was raised to defeat Collins after she voted to confirm Trump's Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. These numbers are significant in a state that, while considered blue, has not unseated a Republican senator since 1972, when the legendary Margaret Chase Smith was defeated. Mal Leary is the political correspondent for Maine Public Radio and a veteran reporter in the state. Mal, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Hello, Ken. How are you?
Well, I'm fine and I'm safe, and I hope that's the case with you and your family. Is everybody safe and well?
Absolutely. We're working from home most of the time. The state house itself is closed. You can't even get into the building as part of the efforts to try to minimize the spread of the virus.
Well, you know, but there's still going to be an election, as far as we know. There's still be an election this year. And, you know, with Susan Collins, we often describe her as being a maverick. And, you know, we point to her support for abortion rights and her vote against repealing Obamacare as examples. But then comes a time to vote on a Trump Supreme Court nominee or a federal judge or the president's tax cut or something like that, and she sticks with her party. Or she'll talk about her concerns regarding Trump, not going much further. Is her reputation unfounded?
Well, her reputation going back over the history of her serving in the Senate has been as a maverick that's gone both ways. But what's really killing her in this election is Donald Trump. when she supports Kavanaugh, his nominee, that caused her a lot of problems with women voters in Maine of both parties. Then we have her making the comment that she thought that what the president was doing was appropriate and fine, I believe was the phrase, dealing with the coronavirus back in January. That has come back to haunt her in television ads, because obviously he hasn't. And, you know, we're worse off than we would have been had he acted much more aggressively to try to deal with the virus. So her fate is being tied closer and closer to Donald Trump, who in Maine has never had statewide, you know, had a positive rating in the polls. Now, the only, you know, if you will, objective look we've got is the Colby College poll that came out a few weeks ago. Seems a few weeks ago now. It was probably more than a month ago, in which they were virtually tied within the margin of error of the poll.
Now, you say they, you mean her, Collins, and Sarah Gideon still has a primary to get through, correct?
She has a primary, but, you know, everyone looks upon her as sort of certain to win it because she has this huge amount of money, and the polls show her way ahead of her opponents. And one thing I got to mention here that is just astounding to most of us is we've already had millions and millions of dollars spent on television ads when the election, of course, isn't until November. And I'm talking about pummeling ads, you know. You know, Sarah Gideon lies to the people of Maine, you know. Oh, Susan Collins is not your friend. Back and forth by the campaigns. And then you've got big super PACs with, you know, their dark money that are also spending money on ads urging defeat of one of the candidates or the other.
Well, let me play this especially seemingly vicious ad put out by the Lincoln Project, which is a group of anti-Trump Republicans.
You keep covering for Trump. Oh, sure. You certainly talk a good game. You're concerned. Troubled. Worried. But one thing you're not? Independent. Madam Senator, this time a finger wag will not cut it. You're a senator, so act like it. You work for Maine, not Mitch McConnell, because Maine demands independence from our leaders. So either do your job, Susan Collins, or Maine will find someone who will.
You know, that's an example, Ken, of the ads that are just coming in from outside groups on top of the ads that the campaigns are running. Now, Mainers are used to having a lot of television ads around election time, you know, 4, 5, 6 weeks out. We're talking months out. And there have been times when you turn on the television set and, you know, the 6 o'clock news is brought to you by pro-Gideon, anti-Gideon, pro-Collins, anti-Collins ads.
In April, 6 months ago.
In April.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's amazing.
I can't remember the last time a Senate race in Maine has gotten this much attention, but people all are talking about this all over the country.
They are, and that's because of the kind of pivotal role that Collins has played on some issues, particularly on abortion legislation and the Affordable Care Act, where she's kind of threaded the needle. And that has been very helpful to her in our state. But when she voted for Kavanaugh, that was the turning point that saw a lot of people go, wait a minute, what is she doing?
Tell me about Sarah Gideon. Who is she?
Sarah is the Speaker of the House. She came up as a state representative from Freeport, which is probably better known for L.L. Bean than it is for Sarah Gideon. She is, I would say, progressive to a degree, but she is also has a practical streak to her. And I'm speaking now from her actions in the legislature. She's been pretty much progressive with a lot of her TV ads, more to things like expansion of Obamacare to almost the level of universal health care.
We have 6 months to go, and as you say, if the airwaves are being bombarded now in April, you know, goodness knows what it's going to look like for the next 6 months. But if you had to, forget about predicting it, but what do you see as the dynamics of the race from now until November?
I see it a very tight race. Collins is going to spend a lot of money talking about the things she's done for the state. Now, she is a senior member of the Appropriations Committee, and she steered a lot of appropriations. We used to call it pork, but of course they did away with that phrase, to the state. There are chunks of the highway that have been built because of earmarks, basically, from Collins sitting on appropriations. She's going to try to take advantage of that and say, look, I work for you, I deliver for you. That's important, folks, and kind of appealing to that practicality. And I think you're going to have the Democrats, Sarah Gideon, saying, this woman's lost it. You know, she is now supporting Trump. She votes for Trump on too many things. It doesn't matter if she's delivering when the country's going down the hole. So you're going to have this real slash and battle, a lot of it having to do with the top of the ticket as much as the race itself for the Senate.
You know, there are so many states where Republicans are latching on to Trump coattails. Susan Collins is probably going to do everything she can not to mention his name in her reelection bid, right?
Absolutely. And you know from things that she has said publicly, let alone things she has said privately, that she can't stand a man. But he's the Republican president. And, you know, she stands by him on too many issues, I think.
Mal Leary is the political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. Mal, thanks as always for being on the show.
Thank you, Ken.
Dear Susan, I know you love me so, but I want to hear it in my ear. You know I'd be there working at my craft had it not been for the draft. Dry up your tear and feel no fear. Coast waiting from Mandy and Vietnam fighting.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It started with an announcement by the President of the United States.
To protect our men who are in Vietnam and to guarantee the continued success of our withdrawal and Vietnamization programs, I have concluded that the time has come for action. In cooperation with the armed forces of South Vietnam, attacks are being launched this week to clean out major enemy sanctuaries on the Cambodian-Vietnam border.
Was this an expansion of the war? Nixon answered that question as he raised it.
This is not an invasion of Cambodia. The areas in which these attacks will be launched are completely occupied and controlled by North Vietnamese forces. Our purpose is not to occupy the areas. Once enemy forces are driven out of these sanctuaries and once their military supplies are destroyed, we will withdraw. A majority of the American people, a majority of you listening to me, are for the withdrawal of our forces from Vietnam. The action I have taken tonight is indispensable for the continuing success of that withdrawal program. A majority of the American people want to end this war rather than to have it drag on interminably. The action I have taken tonight will serve that purpose. We take this action not for the purpose of expanding the war into Cambodia, but for the purpose of ending the war in Vietnam and winning the just peace we all desire.
That was April 30th, 1970, 50 years ago. The reaction, especially on college campuses around the country, was immediate and angry. Protests, boycotts, demonstrations. At Kent State University in Kent, Ohio, angry students burned the ROTC building. Other colleges went through similar upheaval. The day after the bombing of Cambodia began, Nixon was dismissive of the campus demonstrators, calling them bums.
You know, you see these bums, you know, blowing up the campuses. Listen, the boys that are on the college campuses today are the luckiest people in the world.
At Kent State, National Guardsmen were called in to break up the demonstrations. Tragically, they did more than that. On Monday, May 4th, the confrontation between the guardsmen and the protesters turned deadly.
Good evening from ABC News headquarters in New York. I'm Howard K. Smith. Frank Reynolds is on assignment in Indochina. These are tonight's headlines. Four students killed at Kent State University in Ohio during a confrontation with the National Guard at a war protest rally. The active, large-scale American and South Vietnamese participation in the fighting in Cambodia has brought a cry of anger from many college campuses. There was more trouble over the weekend, and today the protest turned into a riot with thousands of demonstrators facing National Guardsmen and police. Someone, possibly a sniper, started shooting, and a few minutes later, four protesters, two women and two men, were dead. At the White House, the president issued a statement saying that he shares the sadness of the parents of those killed, and he added, quote, "This should remind us all once again that when dissent turns to violence, it invites tragedy."
Public opinion on the Vietnam War had already turned by the time of Kent State. The killings became one of the significant events of the day, and that photo of Marianne Vecchio kneeling over the body of slain student Jeffrey Miller is considered one of the most iconic pictures in the history of journalism. A lot has been written about Kent State in the half century since. A lot of it has been factual, a lot has not. That's why a new book, When Truth Mattered, The Kent State Shootings 50 Years Later, is such a timely study. The book is less about the events of May 4th, 1970, and more about the factual reporting of the Akron Beacon Journal of what happened. My guest is the author of the book and the managing editor of the Beacon Journal at the time. Robert Giles, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ken.
Well, 50 years may seem like a long time, but you know, for many of us who were around and following politics back then, it feels like yesterday.
Well, it was a long time ago, and I've carried the story with me all that time. And I was never compelled to write about it until very recently, and when I began to realize that it was 50 years, and I began to look into the background and the circumstances and wondered how people have come to regard the truth-telling that shaped our coverage at Kent State.
Tell us who Robert Giles was in 1970.
Robert Giles was the managing editor of the Akron Beacon Journal in 1970, and I was a young editor. I was 37 years old. I was in charge of the newsroom at that moment because the executive editor, the senior editor in the newsroom, was out of the country. And as he left to go on his trip, he came to me and he said, "I'm leaving. You're going to be in charge. Don't screw it up." And so I had that hanging over my head as we approached our coverage for the weekend. You know, Kent State was not a hotbed of student protests. It was one of the most least likely places for a tragic protest of this kind to take place.
The town of Kent itself was pretty conservative, right?
It was very conservative, and the college, there was 19,000 students in the college, and they had been going through a sort of a cultural revolution of their own. There were a lot of hippies, the kids dressed in torn dungarees and other things, and the townspeople were kind of offended by that.
Well, my response to the shooting in Kent was simply the fact that the people weren't behaving properly, and apparently they have asked for that sort of thing.
What do you think about the shooting at Kent? Do you think it was justified?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry they didn't kill more.
Really?
Really, sir.
More of the students.
Yes, because they were warned and they knew what was happening and they should have moved out.
It was a stunning reaction, but it was a reflection of the tension, the town and gown tension, if you will. The townspeople had become increasingly uncomfortable with the free lifestyle that many of the students were engaged in, and they were offended by the anti-war protest, because in this conservative community, there was a lot of support for our presence in Vietnam, the anti-communist nature of being there, and the draft. There was a lot of opposition on the campus to the draft. The students didn't like it, and many of them had gotten deferments to be there. The townspeople sort of resented this. It's, you know, kids just trying to get out of their duty. Many of the townspeople, of course, had been involved in previous wars, World War II, and maybe even Korea. And they had a sort of a patriotic sense about it was the duty of students to represent their country when it was at war.
And now I want you to describe the growing anger between Nixon's declaration on April 30th that the war would be expanded into Cambodia and the growing number of disturbances on college campuses, especially Kent State.
Well, there were rallies in opposition to Nixon's speech across the country, hundreds of rallies. But Kent State was the only one where students were killed, and that's become the focus. It was a moment when our country changed, and it was a moment in which our thinking about the Vietnam War changed.
In that clip I played earlier, Howard K. Smith of ABC News talked about a possible sniper shooting at the National Guardsmen before they started firing. How long did it take the Beacon Journal to dismiss that as false?
Well, that was the Guard's original complaint, claim that there was a sniper. And the sniper theory held up for several days because the evidence of a sniper was in a metal sculpture right next to the firing scene. It was about 15 feet high, and there was a bullet hole in it. And the bullet hole, to the untrained eye, looked like the bullet had come from the direction of where the demonstrators were towards the National Guard, and it was because one side of the bullet hole was smooth, the other side had metal furrings coming out of it. And we didn't accept that. So we quoted the Guardsmen leaders as saying, well, it was a sniper, but we decided to do a test of our own. And we got a similar piece of metal. We got an M1 rifle and a marksman and some M1 bullets. And we went out into a field and we did some test shooting. And it demonstrated just the opposite. It demonstrated that the bullet had come through the sculpture from the direction of where the guard was shooting. And we ran that story on the following Sunday, May the 10th. And it really sort of took the air out of the claim by the Guardsmen that there was, in fact, a sniper. They tried to hold on to it for a while, but the evidence was so clear from our story that the sniper idea went away.
There was also a report that was widely shared that a guardsman was killed.
There was a report very early on, I mean, immediately after the shooting, by United Press International. They had a reporter on campus, and he was down near the headquarters of the National Guard. And he overheard a telephone conversation on the county sheriff's deputy's telephone, which said, we need some ambulances. We've got two dead up here. And the reporter took that to mean two dead guardsmen. And so UPI sent out this flash to its bureaus in Cleveland and Columbus, saying there were four dead, two students and two National Guardsmen. Meanwhile, we had a young reporter on the campus who was a witness to the shooting, and he knew that there were four dead students. And so we were on deadline. We were an afternoon newspaper, and we had to make a critical decision as to whether to go with the UPI or with our own reporter. And I had to make that decision, and I made it without hesitation. Let's go with our guy.
For quite some time after that day, the country was deeply divided as to who was responsible for the deaths of the four students. The governor at the time was James Rhodes, who sent the National Guardsmen to the campus. He was also running for the Senate that year. Matter of fact, the election took place one day after the shootings. What was Rhodes saying at the time on the weekend leading to it and on May 4th itself?
Well, on the weekend leading to it, he arrived on Sunday morning. He had been in Cleveland debating Bob Taft. And then he came to Kent, and the president of the university at that moment was out of town. He had gone to Iowa to an educational meeting, and Rhodes came and just took charge. He didn't consult with the National Guard. He didn't consult with the university officials. He just took charge, and one of the first things he did when he got to the campus was to make a statement, a speech almost, in which he said some very demeaning things about the students. He called them worse than Nazi brown shirts and the worst kind of stuff we have in this country. And then he went into a meeting with the county officials and listened to the county prosecutor as he made a really strong plea to close the campus on Sunday. Now you can imagine, think about that. If the governor had followed the advice of the county prosecutor and closed the campus, there would have been likely no deaths on Monday. But instead, he said, no, I don't want to close the campus because my opponents will say, well, you gave in to the radicals. And instead, the governor ordered the National Guard to break up a rally that was being planned for noon on Monday. His words were, we will break up all assemblies, peaceful and otherwise. And somebody asked him, well, what's a protest under your order, Governor? And he said, two people walking together.
That was a protest.
Yeah, that was the protest. So that was what set up the situation that unfolded on Monday, and because the students were going to ignore the governor's orders and have their noon rally against the war and the draft.
Well, Rhodes was narrowly defeated the next day, on Tuesday the 5th.
That's correct.
Right, in his bid for the Senate. Do you think the shootings played a role?
I think the shootings probably, I think the shootings probably helped him narrow the distance between the votes he got and the ones Bob Taft got. Taft was well ahead, as I recall, during the run-up to the primary election on May the 5th. And Rhodes had some very aggressive performances and some debates, and he was now playing to his base by being the tough guy and being anti-students and criticizing those who were opposed to the war. And I suspect, this is only speculation, but I suspect that the election on Tuesday in the primary ended up being closer than would otherwise have been the case.
In the end, did anyone get charged, go to prison or anything for the deaths of the four students?
Nobody was ever held accountable. There were a number of court cases that stretched out over 9 years. One of the outcomes was a Supreme Court ruling that said that a public official, elected public official, acting in their office can be sued for their performance under a certain circumstances. And that was the first time that the courts had held that a citizen could sue a sitting office holder. There were 8 guardsmen who were indicted, and they were tried, and they were acquitted. The bottom line is there was no accountability, and that's a deep burning issue with a lot of people who are so heavily involved in remembering Kent State in an emotional way that nobody was ever held to blame.
Robert Giles is the author of When Truth Mattered, The Kent State Shootings 50 Years Later. He's the former managing editor of the Akron Beacon Journal, which, I should add, won the Pulitzer Prize for its reporting. Bob, thanks so much for being on the show.
Enjoyed it, Ken. Thanks for having me.
It was 50 years ago, on May 4th, 1970, when 4 students at Kent State University in Ohio were shot dead by National Guardsmen during a protest against President Nixon's decision to expand the war in Southeast Asia to Cambodia. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Tin soldiers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drum.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.